I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Just ahead, the Barbershop Guys on politics and, what else, sports. But first, each week we explore issues of spirituality in our segment, Faith Matters. Today we want to talk about fundamentalism, specifically Christian fundamentalism. I think it's fair to say that many of us think we know who and what a fundamentalist is. Militant, uncompromising, somebody who brooks no argument. But to Brett Granger, fundamentalists are none of that and all of that. He captures the complexities in his new book, In the World But Not of It, One Family's Militant Faith and the History of Fundamentalism in America. In it, he tells the story of his family and of others throughout the U.S. who have chosen to live their lives following the ardent word of God. Brett Granger joins me now from member station WGBH in Boston. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Great to be here, Michelle.
In your book, you start out calling fundamentalism the F word, which is not what most of us think is the F word. What are you getting at here?
You know, fundamentalists themselves have a very interesting relationship with fundamentalism. When the word was first coined in the 20s by a Baptist minister named Curtis Lee Laws, he meant it in a very positive sense. Fundamentalist was someone willing to fight for the faith. So basically what I'm charting in this course is a shift away from fundamentalism as a word itself. Those initial positive connotations became identified after 25 with belligerence, intolerance, all kinds of backwardness and so on. And so eventually you get to the 50s and 60s where evangelists such as Billy Graham, you know, got rid of the word altogether. He didn't really stop being a fundamentalist in terms of what he believed, but he wanted to get along with American culture. He wanted to basically focus on saving souls, and so he lost that sort of tone that we identify with fundamentalists in the 70s.
Why are you bringing it back? Why
am I bringing it back? Mm-hmm. My point in trying to continue to use it is that I think when we call everybody an evangelical, we lose a certain amount of descriptive power. I think it's fair to say that all fundamentalists are evangelicals, but not all evangelicals are fundamentalists.
Mm-hmm, that's well said. You mentioned, obviously, you have a master's in divinity, right? So you've studied, mm-hmm. and you've studied fundamentalism in a global context. But in the Christian context, are there core beliefs that define fundamentalism in the U.S.?
I think you could still say that the original five fundamentals of faith that were hammered out in the late 19th century still hold today. But I actually feel that the doctrinal stuff is less important than the kind of approach they take to being in the world but not of it. George Marsden put it very well when he said, you know, a fundamentalist is an evangelical with an attitude.
And when you say attitude, you mean like a tood.
Exactly. They're angry. You know, they're upset. They got something to say. I think when you think of Billy Graham, you don't think of someone who's angry at America. You know, he wants to spread the gospel. And to do that, I think he toned down the tood. And that's how he reached so many people.
What do you think is the biggest misconception that many people have about fundamentalists in the U.S., Christian fundamentalists mm-hmm. in the U.S.?
I think there's this assumption that they all agree, you know, within themselves. I think that's a great misconception. You know, the fundamentalists that I grew up with, they weren't interested in world domination. They just wanted to be left alone. They didn't even vote. You know, to vote was to be complicit in the world. It was to be sort of contaminated by the things of the world.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News, and I'm speaking with author Brett Granger about his new book, In the World, But Not of It. It's a memoir and a history of fundamentalism in the U.S. Tell me about your family.
Oh, my family. Well, my family on both sides were members of the Plymouth Brethren, which is this very small, militant group of fundamentalists that were founded in the 19th century. I sort of had a unique experience in that, you know, while I swam in this sea of fundamentalist faith. On the other hand, I kind of emerged from it relatively untouched. And part of the reason for that, I think, is because, you know, both my parents were sort of black sheep in their family. And so by the time I was coming up, you know, participation was mandatory, but I didn't get the kind of, you know, guilt from my parents that that a lot of my friends did. So in some ways, I was kind of in the brethren, but not of them. I definitely imbibed the worldview, but when it came time for me to leave, I didn't feel burned by the tradition. I felt very much like I was taking away the pluses and sort of escaping some of the more constricting aspects of the faith.
You write a wonderful section about your grandparents waiting for the rapture, which I have to say I found hilarious and touching at the same time. But explain, first of all, what the rapture is and why are they waiting for it. And I think I may have you read a section about that, too. But set it up for us. Explain. What's the rapture?
And sure.
Why were they waiting for it? Mm-hmm.
So the rapture is this belief that Jesus will return imminently in secret for all the true believers. So, you know, obviously the second coming is a very old Christian doctrine, but what's special about the rapture is that it kind of breaks up the second coming into two events. So you've got this first second coming when Jesus returns and secretly kind of gathers up all the believers and, you know, they'll leave behind all their little piles of clothes and glasses and stuff. And then there's the second coming 7 years after that when he comes back real kind of public and carrying a big stick and he beats up all the bad guys. He
swaggers into town.
Exactly.
Gets it done.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's high noon.
Mm-hmm. So the trick here is that they had actually identified the day when this was going to happen.
The reason my grandfather got wrapped up in this was because he'd read a pamphlet by Edward Weisenant, who's a former NASA engineer who'd gotten into, you know, the Bible and done some number crunching and come up with a date for the rapture, which he pinpointed in 1988. So my grandfather, who was a lay evangelist, got very involved in spreading this within the brethren. And he, you know, there was a day in October that he actually spent, you know, sitting in in the living room with my grandmother, waiting for this to happen.
And this was so controversial that members of his congregation literally asked him not to come to church that day because they didn't want to hear all about this. They thought, you know, let's just keep this under wraps, buddy. And you know, can I ask you to read this section, a little section from the book where they're waiting?
Sure. Mm-hmm. So I'll just set this up. This is my grandfather in the living room on the day when he's waiting for the Lord to return. He read to comfort himself. Then he prayed. He prayed for his six children and for their families, for the grandchildren who were still dead in their sins, that the Spirit would strive with them, roiling the waters of the heart until they acknowledged their utter depravity and professed their faith in the cross of Jesus Christ, in the bloodshed at Calvary. He prayed for the Lord's glorious appearing, for the rapture of the saints, for the promise of a new heaven and a new earth. My grandmother played a hymn at the organ, then, feeling restless, took up her knitting. An old clock ticked away the countdown. She paused in mid-stitch, displeased to realize that she would be leaving a work half-finished. Setting aside her needles, she resolved to make some last-minute phone calls to loved ones. One of the calls was to my mother. My grandmother told her that we should help ourselves to her homemade preserves and ginger cookies. "We won't be needing them," she said gaily. This upset my mother. As she later pointed out, it insinuated that our family would be stuck with last summer's chutney while the saints feasted in glory.
And needless to say, perhaps not needless to say, the rapture did not come that day. Was this a crisis for the family?
It was more a social crisis than a crisis of faith. I don't think my grandfather ever once doubted his faith, even after this, you know, this calamity. But certainly in terms of the community we were a part of, it's a tiny little community, and certainly it was very difficult for us to show our faces at church for some time.
One of the things I like about the book is that you don't shy away from the fact that for some people, what is obvious and true and possible to others suggests mental illness, you know, visions, you know, and I'd like to ask how you, as you became an adult, kind of grappled with the fact that for some, you know, some people, real possibilities, the real possibility, you know, of heaven on earth, of being kind of restored to glory and so forth, for some people really is a sign that there's something wrong. And for some people, it's just a very deep belief. Do you know what I mean? Could you talk about that?
There's all kinds of things that we do that don't make any sense. You can find, you know, someone who doesn't believe in God but avoids, you know, stepping on cracks in the sidewalk. That's just as irrational to me as to believe that, you know, some guy 2,000 years ago died and was buried and resurrected. Just because, you know, fundamentalists wait for Jesus to come again doesn't mean that they're working out some kind of mass cultural neurosis or mental illness.
Well, it is interesting to contemplate. I think it is an 18th century Enlightenment conceit that if we are presented with the same facts, we will all come to the same conclusion.
Mm.
And that's clearly not the case. But what do you make of the fact that fundamentalism persists in a modern, technologically rich world? Where we don't have the isolation of sort of geographic boundaries, of sort of minimal communication tools and things of that sort. You know, what do you make of it?
For one, it says something about the enduring appeal of strong militant faith. I think, you know, the fact that these are the churches that continue to grow while, you know, the liberal mainline churches continue to shrink. I think there's obviously something that these communities are offering people that they're finding that they're not finding in the liberal mainline denominations.
One of the other questions I have, and particularly because you are a student of fundamentalist movements around the world, is that many Americans have this notion that fundamentalism thrives overseas in countries that are poor and frustrating, right? Mm. In which particularly young people have a difficult time advancing, and that this provides them an outlet for their desire for meaning. But that isn't the case in the U.S. The U.S. is still a rich country. There are people in this country who are not, you know, well off. But in global terms, we are very well off. So again, another question about why you think, is it just that we're so wrong about the rest of the world, or is it there's something that we're not getting about the meaning, the riches, the attraction of fundamentalism?
I think this is a very comfortable, you know, liberal explanation for fundamentalism, to say, oh, well, you know, these poor people are down on their luck. The world's not going their way, and so this is the only option they have to turn to this faith. That's kind of patronizing to me. I think, you know, there are good reasons often why people choose to become fundamentalists, and, you know, it behooves us to listen to some of those before we pass judgment.
Finally, I wanted to ask about you and your own struggle to find your place in the world spiritually. You talk about the fact that you were always kind of questioning. Your parents had been sort of questioners. You questioned, and that by your teens you'd fallen away from the Plymouth Brethren. But as an adult, there was a void. We talk about that and how you reconciled the worlds in which you have one foot in both.
I didn't have a hard time leaving the Brethren, but what I discovered was that, you know, the Brethren had a hard time leaving me. I think, you know, one thing that I had difficulty shedding was this idea that in evangelical circles that you're sort of called out of the world. And, you know, all I wanted to do in high school was to be in the world and to belong. And after a while, I guess I sort of discovered that belonging wasn't all it was cracked up to be. I still feel very much like there are these parts of myself that, you know, in one part I'm this kind of modern person who believes in evolution and believes that the world runs a certain way. And in another part of me, you know, I believe all kinds of other things that don't make a lot of sense as a modern, rational, you know, Western person. And I don't expect to work that out. I'm happy to live with the contradictions and to try and live in the space between them.
Brett Granger is the author of In the World But Not of It, One Family's Militant Faith and the History of Fundamentalism in America. He joined us from member station WGBH in Boston. Brett Granger, thank you so much for talking to us.
It was my pleasure.